Well, today's sermon is called Creation, Lamentation and Hope. And I'm going to start off talking a bit about history and the Industrial Revolution, which began in Britain in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But where exactly did it start? Well, historians argue about this, and they suggest places like the Lancashire Woolen Mills, Coalbrookdale, and other places with factories and iron forges. But how about Portsmouth, where I was a couple of weeks ago? I saw this in Portsmouth Dockyard, the historic dockyard, not where all the ships are exactly, but just walking around. And I wonder, what on earth are they? These kind of wheels in the ceiling. And this is one of the old buildings in Portsmouth Dockyard. And these are wheels are connected to a steam engine. And at one end, there's a kind of steam engine. And the other end, there's a sort of belt system that drives machinery. And these were developed to make these things. Does anyone know what they're called? It begins with B. Blocks. That's right. And they're blocks on ships' rigging. And fun fact, sometimes they come too close together and then they're said to be chock-a-block. That's where it comes from. Anyway, in the late 1700s, these blocks were made by hand, and then a man called Marc Brunel, who was the father of the famous engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel, he made a machine that mechanized production of these blocks for the Royal Navy, for their ships, because they needed hundreds of thousands of them. And so almost overnight, the making of these ships' blocks went from being handmade to machine-made and increased the output of the production of these blocks by about 20-fold. Anyway, the point is, these machines came in the Industrial Revolution, which started in Britain. And I think I've got a... This is a bit of Portsmouth. This is a picture, actually it's a postcard from Woolwich Arsenal, where they had these belt-driven machines, which you can see the belts go up to those wheels in the ceiling, and they drive various machines. And here they're making fuses for armaments. This is about 1916, this picture. And if you can imagine working in that environment, now the Industrial Revolution was about 100 years before, but still they're using this rather, actually quite hazardous, noisy, dusty environment that these women, thousands of women worked at Woolwich Arsenal, had to endure to make things for the war effort, particularly fuses for bombs. But also, of course, by this time, there were thousands of woolen and cotton mills, and then trains used these engines which were invented, and production of oil, plastics and chemicals, clearing of forests and jungles by huge machines, everything you can think of. And the point is that this is the point, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when carbon dioxide was started to be produced by the burning of fossil fuels in these engines and machines and eventually trains and other forms of transport. Of course, they didn't know that then, but we know it now, that the rise in carbon dioxide levels due to fossil fuel burning has led to climate change in our planet. And then up until the Industrial Revolution, human beings generally looked after the land and sea where they lived. But the Industrial Revolution, of course, led to massive pollution and mechanized exploitation of the land and sea, as I'll show you in a moment. And in a way, people became machines. And there were a lot of accidents in these factories, although people moan about health and safety and stuff. It had a huge impact in our lifetimes of making these workplaces safe as people worked with machines for various in various jobs. But at that time, you know, they worked in, as I said, overcrowded, noisy, dangerous, and squalid environments. And all this took place in Great Britain, starting, as I said, in Portsmouth, and then up north in the mills. And then it spread around the world. So when we're talking about what we've done to the planet as human beings, remember that it started right here in Britain and went around the world. And as we know, the damage machines have done, not only from carbon dioxide, but through trashing the earth, as it were, has got worse and worse, up to the point where people question whether we as human beings have the right to exploit the planet for ourselves. And here are some photos which will just illustrate that. Now, this looks rather pretty, doesn't it? These colourful pools of water. But actually, what it is, it's in West Germany. It used to be an ancient forest, and it was bought in the 1970s by a West German company who completely trashed it and removed all the trees because underneath was coal. And these are sort of stepped coal mining areas. This is obviously surface coal, open cast mining. So though it's a rather beautiful picture, in fact, it tells a really horrible, terrible story of what they did. And then, of course, quarries and other types of work on the land with huge machines gradually increased. And we end up with forests felled for wood. And that lower picture, I think, I'm not sure exactly where it's taken, I think it might be South America, but huge tracts of forest land destroyed so that we as human beings can have a better lifestyle. And even, you know, in London, if you in London on a particular day in Greenwich Park, and you can sometimes see, especially on a very hot day, the pollution cloud over our city, just to remind us of what we are doing to the air and to the planet. And we have to say, of course, the Industrial Revolution and all that goes with it has brought us a lot of benefits. You know, we have cheaper, more reliable goods, prosperity, technology. There's been a decline in almost every country in the world, a decline in poverty, decline in child mortality, and increased lifespans. So you might ask, you might think you wandered into a history lecture this morning, but why am I talking about machines? And as I said, we're concluding today our series on caring for creation. And these pictures and our British history and industry that spread around the world might lead us to a place of despair. What on earth are we going to do for the future generations? And, you know, as people like Greta Thunberg and others, young people go on strike from school and have rallies and so on, they're seeing that our planet is not going to be habitable for them in the future. And even now, its problems are occurring. But also, apart from lamenting with despair what's going on, we also have hope. Now, the Old Testament passage we heard earlier was from the book of Jeremiah, and this was most likely written about 600 BC, and it's a poetic lament for the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian Empire. And the Jeremiah's predicting and prophesying about what's going to happen to Jerusalem. But as we read it now, it does seem there are some phrases in that reading we heard that are really remarkably relevant to our own time. He said, you know, the whole land is laid waste. I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. And because of the earth, this, the earth shall mourn, and the heavens grow black. In many ways, it's almost it links in really well to our own perception of the ecological crisis and the damage we're doing to God's creation. I mean, it's on the news every day. I don't need to labour the point, and we've had three other sermons this month thinking about it. But it's not just mechanised destruction of the earth, but loss of biodiversity, loss of species which will never come back again, and contamination of the whole world with plastics and climate change. I don't know if you know where this is. That little place point is in the Pacific Ocean. It's called the Mariana Trench, and it goes down about 7 miles, it's 11 kilometres, in this very remote part of the Pacific Ocean. And they send little, I don't know what you call them, sort of drone things down there, underwater devices. And this is a picture of something 7 miles down. And I don't know if you can see it, it's a plastic bag at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. It's the lowest level piece of plastic rubbish that is known in the world. And it looks a bit like a supermarket bag or something you had your apples in. And we also see, I won't go into it, but we see animals trapped in plastic, you know, with things you get on packs of beer stuck around their necks. And only last week in the Thames, they did a study, reported on a study of crabs in the Thames, and showed that many had huge numbers of plastic fibres in their stomachs and in their gills and other bits of them. And so as Christians and as a church, we must do everything we can to minimise our impact on our beautiful and amazing world and encourage all who live in our community to do the same. Sometimes I leave the car at home, which is obviously a good thing, and walk down to church. But most times I walk down to church up from Charlton, where I live, you just see endless piles of takeaway food boxes, empty sweet packets, tin cans, and so on. And you think, if people can't even carry a simple box or tin to a rubbish bin nearby, what hope is there of saving the planet? And as we saw from our young people last week, or when we had a Deanery Synod meeting, that you know they are very concerned and trying to do what they can to reduce our consumption and waste. And so what we need for us is not just instructions to recycle or do this or do that, even under compulsion of law. What we need is a change of mind and heart to live more simply, more cleanly, and more unselfishly. And we need to believe what the science is telling us about climate change and the impact, especially on the poorer people of the world and those living in low-lying countries, and the impact, as I said, on future generations. But how will we ever fix this mess? Well, this is where we come to the hope. We've had the kind of lamentation, as it were, of what's been going on. But what hope can we have? At the end of the Jeremiah reading, it says, thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be a desolation, yet I will not make a full end. There's a sort of little bit of hope there in Jeremiah. Although he was talking, as I said, about Jerusalem, if we take it for ourselves, the sense of desolation, there's a hope that it won't be for always. But turning to our gospel reading, it's on page 7, and you might think, well, this is a slightly odd reading for this subject. It's a passage we usually have in Lent, the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness, and you might think, well, what relevance has that got to what I'm talking about this morning? But in this passage, Jesus is tempted by the devil. As you're sure you're familiar with, firstly, command this stone to become a loaf of bread. Secondly, Jesus was shown in an instant all the kingdoms of the world and asked to gain those kingdoms by worshipping Satan. And thirdly, he was taken up to the pinnacle of the temple and told to throw himself off, because if you're the Son of God, God will protect you. Now, what's going on here, which is relevant to today's talk, is that Jesus is being tempted to misuse his power from God. To turn stone into bread is against nature. It's like a magic trick, really. It's an unnatural event. Jesus, of course, turned water into wine and bread into fish, but in nature, water through the grapevine becomes wine, bread and fish multiply in the natural order of things. But bread into stone is stone into bread is something very against nature. So gaining all the kingdoms of the world. So that was the first temptation. The second one, gaining all the kingdoms of the world, it's really a symbol of lust for power and dominion over others. It says in Genesis that, you know, human beings are given dominion, but dominion does not mean domination and destruction. Dominion has within it a sense of care. But the temptation of Jesus to gain power is clearly something he resisted. And then throwing himself off the pinnacle, the third temptation, it's testing God and a misuse of his special relationship with the Father. So, in a wonderful way, Jesus resists all those temptations. And in order to set our world right, we have to do the same things. Firstly, we don't misuse our considerable powers to do that which is against nature. Everything we've been thinking about in these weeks of thinking about creation. We don't misuse our powers against nature. And so we're going to have to make do with less synthetic materials, less fossil fuels, minimize destruction of forests and land, or damage to the ice caps and sea. So that's something for the whole of humanity to do. And secondly, we must avoid our desire to dominate others and nature for financial gain, as we've seen destroying the delicate balance of the world. And so governments are going to have to limit the ways in which industry and technology harms the world. It's easier said than done, of course, when you think of 7 billion people on this planet. And thirdly, we don't misuse our relationship with God. So we do not ignore his precepts and laws, and we don't try not to spoil the image of God in which we are formed. As Michael said last week, the universe shows incredible beauty of the created order. You only have to go out in the garden afterwards to think how, you know, these beautiful plants and things, how can that be? God is within all these things. And man's effects should, our effects on the world should bring us to humility and a recognition of our responsibility for the care of the world. But also, God has given human beings an ingenuity to design and create. And to end on the note of hope, people are working tremendously hard to protect the future. And in the United States, for example, the economy related to green issues is much, much greater now than the economy related to fossil fuels, no matter what the president says. There's been a huge sea change of how money is spent in the States to overcome what I've been talking about. People are designing better batteries, wind and solar power. Tree planting on a massive scale is going on in China. I mean, hundreds, if not thousands, of square miles of tree planting, and so on. And maybe it might be possible to get rid of carbon dioxide in the air, which is too high. The other day, I was in Trafalgar Square when there was an Extinction Rebellion rally. I don't think I'll be gluing myself to the road anytime soon, but you have to admit their message is really getting across. I have to say I wasn't didn't really agree, and there was some controversy about them stopping the tube trains, because in fact the tubes are incredibly ecologically good way of travelling. But anyway, they've raised the bar of, and people take notice, and it's a bit sad you have to do that sort of thing for people to take notice of the, as it says, the risk of extinction of the human race. There is a sense of panic and emergency, as they say. But as Christians, we must look to ourselves and our churches to support any action that's needed to repair the earth after the, as I said at the beginning, the Industrial Revolution of the last 200 years, which started in this country. And like Jeremiah, we can lament what's happening to the planet, but also like Jesus in the wilderness, we can resist the temptation to misuse our desires for power and domination and to misuse the privilege of our special position as human beings. And instead, we have a genuine hope that we can indeed and will make the right decisions, not just for us, but for the future generations. Amen.